Go and tell Gaither to wrap the baby up well. It's a long time since I heard a theatre played properly. McGrath was entranced, as usual. The theatre was no more than some lengths of painted sacking. A plank stage, laid over a few barrels, and half a dozen benches set out in the village square. But at the same time it also managed to become the castle, another part of the castle, the same part a little later, the battlefield, and now it was a road outside the city. The afternoon would have been perfect if it wasn't for Granny Weatherwax. After several piercing glares at the three-man orchestra to see if she could work out which instrument the theatre was, the old witch had finally paid attention to the stage, and it was beginning to become apparent to McGrath that there were certain fundamental aspects of the theatre that Granny had not yet grasped. She was currently bouncing up and down on her stool with rage.
"He's killed him!" she hissed. "Why isn't anyone doing anything about it? He's killed him, and right up there in front of everyone!"
McGrath held on desperately to her colleague's arms as she struggled to get to her feet.
"It's all right," she whispered. "He's not dead."
"Are you calling me a liar, my girl?" snapped Granny.
"I saw it all!"
"Look, Granny, it's not really real, do you see?" Granny Weatherwax subsided a little, but still grumbled under her breath. She was beginning to feel that things were trying to make a fool of her. Up on the stage, a man in a sheet was giving a spirited monologue. Granny listened intently for some minutes and then nudged McGrath in the ribs.
"What's he on about now?" she demanded.
"He's saying how sorry he was that the other man's dead," said McGrath, and in an attempt to change the subject, added hurriedly, "There's a lot of crowns, isn't there?" Granny was not to be distracted.
"What do you go and kill him for, then?" she said.
"Well, it's a bit complicated," said McGrath weakly.
"It's shameful," snapped Granny. "And the poor dead thing still lying there."
McGrath gave an imploring look to Nanny Ogg, who was masticating an apple and studying the stage with the glare of a research scientist.
"I reckon," she said slowly, "I reckon it's all just pretending. Look, he's still breathing."
The rest of the audience, who by now had already decided that this commentary was all part of the play, stared as one man at the corpse. It blushed.
"And look at his boots, too," said Nanny critically. "A real king would be ashamed of boots like that."
The corpse tried to shuffle its feet behind a cardboard bush. Granny, feeling in some obscure way that they had scored a minor triumph over the purveyors of untruth and artifice, helped herself to an apple from the bag and began to take a fresh interest. McGrath's nerves started to unknot, and she began to settle down to enjoy the play. But not, as it turned out, for very long. Her willing suspension of disbelief was interrupted by a voice saying,
"What's this bit?"
McGrath sighed. "Well," she hazarded, "he thinks that he is the prince, but he's really the other king's daughter dressed up as a man." Granny subjected the actor to a long, analytical stare.
"He is a man," she said, "in a straw wig, making his voice squeaky."
McGrath shuddered. She knew a little about the conventions of the theatre. She had been dreading this bit. Granny Weatherwax had views.
"Yes, but," she said wretchedly, "it's the theatre. See, all the women are played by men."
"Why?"
"They don't allow no women on the stage," said McGrath in a small voice. She shut her eyes. In fact, there was no outburst from the seat on her left. She risked a quick glance. Granny was quietly chewing the same bit of apple over and over again, her eyes never leaving the action.
"Don't make a fuss, Esme," said Nanny,
who also knew about Granny's views.
"This is a good bit. I reckon I'm getting the hang of it.
Someone tapped Granny on the shoulder, and a voice said,
Madam, will you kindly remove your hat?
Granny turned around very slowly on her stool, as though propelled by hidden motors, and subjected the interrupter to 100-kilowatt diamond blue stare. The man wilted under it and sagged back on his stool, her face following him all the way down.
No,
she said. He considered the options.
All right, he said.
Granny turned back and nodded to the actors, who had paused to watch her.
I don't know what you're staring at, she growled. Get on with it.
Nanny Ogg passed her another bag.
Have a humbug, she said.
Silence again filled the makeshift theatre, except for the hesitant voices of the actors, who kept glancing at the bristling figure of Granny Weatherwax, and the sucking sounds of a couple of boiled humbugs being relentlessly churned from cheek to cheek. Then Granny said, in a piercing voice that made one actor drop his wooden sword,
There's a man over on the side there, whispering to them.
He's a prompter, said McGrath. He tells them what to say.
Don't they know?
I think they're forgetting, said McGrath sourly, for some reason. Granny nudged Nanny Ogg.
What's going on now? She said. Why are all them kings and people up there?
It's a banquet, see? Said Nanny Ogg authoritatively. Because the dead king, him in the boots, as was, only now if you look you'll see he's pretending to be a soldier, and everyone's making speeches about how good he was, and wondering who killed him.
Are they?
Said Granny grimly. She cast her eyes along the cast, looking for the murderer. She was making up her mind. Then she stood up, her black shawl billowing around her like the wings of an avenging angel, come to rid the world of all that was foolishness and pretense and artifice and sham. She seemed somehow a lot bigger than normal. She pointed an angry finger at the guilty party.
He done it,
she shouted triumphantly.
We all seed him. He done it with a dagger.
The audience filed out, contented. It had been a good play on the whole, they decided, although not very easy to follow. But it had been a jolly good laugh when all the kings had run off, and the woman in black had jumped up and did all the shouting. That alone had been well worth the halfpenny admission. The three witches sat alone on the edge of the stage.
I wonder how they get all them kings and lords to come here and do this, said Granny, totally unabashed. I'd have thought they'd have been too busy ruling and similar.
No, said McGrath wearily. I still don't think you quite understand.
Well, I'm going to get to the bottom of it, snapped Granny.
She got back on the stage and pulled aside the sacking curtains.
You,
she shouted.
You're dead.
The luckless former corpse, who was eating a ham sandwich to calm his nerves, fell backwards off his stool. Granny kicked a bush. Her boot went right through it.
See,
she said to the world in general in a strangely satisfied voice,
nothing's real. It's all just paint and sticks and paper at the back.
May I assist you, good ladies?
It was a rich and wonderful voice, with every diphthong gliding beautifully into place. It was a golden brown voice. If the creator of the multiverse had a voice, it was a voice such as this. If it had a drawback, it was that it wasn't a voice you could use, for example, for ordering coal. Coal ordered by this voice would become diamonds. It apparently belonged to a large fat man who had been badly savaged by a moustache. Pink veins made a map of quite a large city on his cheeks. His nose could have hidden successfully in a bowl of strawberries. He wore a ragged jerkin and holy tights with an aplomb that nearly convinced you that his velvet and vermin robes were in the wash just at the moment. In one hand he held a towel with which he had clearly been removing the makeup that still greased his features.
I know you, said Granny. You done the murder.
She looked sideways at McGrath and admitted grudgingly,
leastways it looked like it.
So glad. It's always a pleasure to meet a true connoisseur. Ulwin Vitala, at your service. Manager of this band of vagabonds,
said the man, and removing his moth-eaten hat, he treated her to a low bow. It was less an obeisance than an exercise in advanced topology. The hat swerved and jerked through a series of complex arcs, ending up at the end of an arm which was now pointing in the direction of the sky. One of his legs, meanwhile, had wandered off behind him. The rest of his body sagged politely until his head was level with Granny's knees.
Yes. Well, said Granny.
She felt that her clothes had grown a bit larger and much hotter.
I thought you was very good, too, said Nanny Ogg. The way you shouted all them words so graciously, I could tell you was a king.
I hope we didn't upset things, said McGrath.
My dear lady, said Vitala, could I begin to tell you how gratifying it is for a mere mama to learn that his audience has seen behind the mere shell of grease paint to the spirit beneath?
I expect you could, said Granny. I expect you could say anything, Mr. Vitala.
He replaced his hat, and their eyes met in a long and calculating stare of one professional weighing up another. Vitala broke first and tried to pretend he had not been competing.
"And now," he said, "to what do I owe this visit from three such charming ladies?"
In fact, he'd won. Granny's mouth fell open. She would not have described herself as anything much above handsome, considering. Nanny, on the other hand, was as gummy as a baby and had a face like a small dried raisin. The best you could say for McGrath was that she was decently plain and well-scrubbed and as flat-chested as an ironing-board with a couple of peas on it, even if her head was too well-stuffed with fancies. Granny could feel something, some sort of magic at work, but not the kind she was used to. It was Vitala's voice. By the mere process of articulation, it transformed everything it talked about.
"Look at the two of them," she told herself, "primping away like a couple of ninnies."
Granny stopped her hand in the process of patting her own iron-hard bun and cleared her throat meaningfully.
"We'd like to talk to you, Mr. Vitala."
She indicated the actors, who were dismantling the set and staying well out of her way, and added with a conspiratorial whisper,
"Somewhere private."
"Dear lady, but of a certain," he said, "currently I have lodgings in yon esteemed watering-hole."
The witches looked around. Eventually McGrath risked, "You mean the pub?" It was cold and draughty in the great hall of Loncre Castle, and the new chamberlain's bladder wasn't getting any younger. He stood and squirmed under the gaze of Lady Felmet.
"Oh, yes," he said. "We've got them all right. Lots."
"And people don't do anything about them?"
said the Duchess. The Chamberlain blinked.
"I'm sorry?" he said.
"People tolerate them?"
"Oh, indeed," said the Chamberlain happily. "It's considered good luck to have a witch living in your village. My word, yes."
"Why?"
The Chamberlain hesitated. The last time he had resorted to a witch, it had been because certain rectal problems had turned the privy into a daily torture chamber, and the jar of ointment she had prepared had turned the world into a nicer place.
"They smooth out life's little humps and bumps," he said.
"Where I come from, we don't allow witches," said the Duchess, sternly. "And we don't propose to allow them here. You will furnish us with their addresses."
"Addresses, ladyship?"
"Where they live, and trust your text-gatherers know where to find them."
Ah,
said the Chamberlain miserably. The Duke leaned forward on his throne.
I trust,
he said,
that they do pay taxes.
Not exactly pay taxes, my lord, said the Chamberlain. There was silence. Finally the Duke prompted,
Go on, man.
Well, it's more that they don't pay, you see. We never felt, that is, the old king didn't think, well, they just don't. The Duke laid a hand on his wife's arm.
I see,
he said coldly.
Very well, you may go.
The Chamberlain gave him a brief nod of relief and scuttled crabwise from the hall.
Well, said the Duchess. Indeed. That was how your family used to run a kingdom, was it? You had a positive duty to kill your cousin. It was clearly in the interests of the species, said the Duchess. The weak don't deserve to survive.
The Duke shivered. She would keep on reminding him. He didn't, on the whole, object to killing people, or at least ordering them to be killed, and then watching it happen, but killing a kingsman, rather stuck in the throat, or, he recalled, the liver.
Quite so,
he managed.
Of course, there would appear to be many witches, and it might be difficult to find the three that were on the moor. That doesn't matter. Of course not. Put matters in hand. Yes, my love.
Matters in hand. He'd put matters in hand, all right. If he closed his eyes, he could see the body tumbling down the steps. Had there been a hiss of shocked breath down in the darkness of the hall? He'd been certain they were alone. Matters in hand. He'd tried to wash the blood off his hand. If he could wash the blood off, he told himself, it wouldn't have happened. He scrubbed and scrubbed, scrubbed till he screamed. Granny wasn't at home in public houses. She sat stiffly to attention behind her port and lemon, as if it were a shield against the lures of the world. Nanny Ogg, on the other hand, was enthusiastically downing her third drink. And, Granny thought sourly, was well along that path which would probably end up with her usual dancing on the table, showing her petticoats and singing, The hedgehog can never be buggered at all. The table was covered with copper coins. Vitola and his wife sat at either end counting. It was something of a race. Granny considered Mrs. Vitola as she snatched farthings from under her husband's fingers. She was an intelligent-looking woman, appeared to treat her husband much as a sheepdog treats a favourite lamb. The complexities of the marital relationship were known to Granny only from a distance, in the same way that an astronomer can view the surface of a remote and alien world. But it had already occurred to her that a wife to Vitola would have to be a very special woman with bottomless reserves of patience and organisational ability and nimble fingers.
Mrs. Vitola, she said eventually, may I make so bold as to ask if your union has been blessed with fruit?
The couple looked blank.
She means,
Nanny Ogg began. No, I see, said Mrs. Vitola quietly. No, we had a little girl once. A small cloud hung over the table. For a second or two, Vitola looked merely human-sized and much older. He stared at the small pile of cash in front of him.
Only, you see, there is this child,
said Granny, indicating the baby in Nanny Ogg's arms.
And he needs a home.
The Vitola stared. Then the man sighed.
It's no life for a child, he said. Always moving, always a new town, and no room for schooling. They say it's very important these days.
But his eyes didn't look away. Mrs. Vitola said, Why does he need a home?
He hasn't got one, said Granny. At least, not one where he would be welcome.
The silence continued. Then Mrs. Fatola said, And you, who ask this, you are by way of being his...
Godmothers, said Nanny Ogg promptly.
Granny was slightly taken aback. It would never have occurred to her. Fatola played abstractedly with the coins in front of him. His wife reached out across the table and touched his hand, and there was a moment of unspoken communion. Granny looked away. She had grown expert at reading faces, but there were times when she preferred not to.
Money is, alas, tight,
Fatola began.
But it will stretch,
said his wife firmly.
Yes, I think it will. We should be happy to take care of him.
Granny nodded and fished in the deepest recesses of her cloak. At last she produced a small leather bag, which she tipped out onto the table. There was a lot of silver, and even a few tiny gold coins.
This should take care of,
she groped.
Nappies and such like. Clothes and things, whatever.
100 times over, I should think,
said Fatola weakly.
Why didn't you mention this before?
If I'd had to buy you, you wouldn't be worth the price.
But you don't know anything about us, said Mrs. Fatola.
We don't, do we? Said Granny calmly. Naturally, we'd like to hear how he gets along. You could send us letters and such like. But it would not be a good idea to talk about all this after you've left, you see, for the sake of the child.
Mrs. Fatola looked at the two old women. There's something else, isn't there? She said. Something big behind all this. Granny hesitated and then nodded. But it would do us no good at all to know it. Another nod. Granny stood up as several actors came in, breaking the spell. Actors had a habit of filling all the space around them.
I have other things to see to, she said. Please excuse me.
What's his name?
Said Fatola.
Tom,
said Granny, hardly hesitating.
John,
said Nanny. The two witches exchanged glances. Granny won.
Tom John,
she said firmly, and swept out. She met a breathless McGrath outside the door. I found a box, she said. It had all the crowns and things in, so I put it in, like you said, right underneath everything.
Good,
said Granny. Our crown looked really tatty compared to the others.
Just goes to show, doesn't it? Said Granny. Did anyone see you?
No, everyone was too busy, but... McGrath hesitated. She blushed.
Out with it, girl.
Just after that, a man came up and pinched my bottom. McGrath went a deep crimson and slapped her hand over her mouth.
Did he?
Said Granny.
And then what?
And then...
Yes?
He said...
What did he say?
He said, Hello, my lovely. What are you doing tonight? Granny ruminated on this for a while and then said,
Old Goody Whimper. She didn't get out and about much, did she?
It was her leg, you know, said McGrath.
But she taught you all about the midwifery and everything.
Oh, yes, that, said McGrath. I'd done lots.
But...
Granny hesitated, groping her way across unfamiliar territory.
She never talked about what you might call the previous.
Sorry?
You know,
said Granny, with an edge of desperation in her voice,
men and such.
McGrath looked as if she was about to panic. What about them? Granny Weatherwax had done many unusual things in her time, and it took a lot to make her refuse a challenge, but this time she gave in.
I think,
she said helplessly,
that it might be a good idea if you have a quiet word with Nanny Ogg one of these days. Fairly soon.
There was a cackle of laughter from the window behind them, a chink of glasses, and a thin voice raised in song.
With a giraffe, if you stand on a stool, but the hedgehog...
Granny stopped listening.
Only not just now, she added.
The troop got underway a few hours before sunset, their four carts lurching off down the road that led towards the Stowe Plains and the big cities. Locre had a town rule that all mummers, mountebanks, and other potential criminals were outside the gates by sundown. It didn't offend anyone, really, because the town had no walls to speak of, and no one much minded if people nipped back in again after dark. It was the look of the thing that counted. The witches watched from McGrath's cottage, using Nanny Ogg's ancient green crystal ball.
"It's about time you learned how to get sound on this thing,"
Granny muttered. She gave it a nudge, filling the image with ripples. "It was very strange," said McGrath. "In those carts, the things they had, paper trees and all kinds of costumes, and—" She waved her hands. "There was this great big picture of faun parts, with all temples and things, all rolled up. It was beautiful." Granny grunted. "I thought it was amazing the way all those people became kings and things, didn't you? It was like magic."
"McGrath, Garlic, what are you saying? It was just paint and paper. Anyone could see that."
McGrath opened her mouth to speak, ran the ensuing argument through her head, and shut it again. "Where's Nanny?" she said.
"She's lying out on the lawn," said Granny. "She felt a bit poorly."
And from outside came the sound of Nanny Ogg being poorly at the top of her voice. McGrath sighed. "You know," she said, "if we are his godmothers, we ought to have given him three gifts. It's traditional."
"What are you talking about, girl?"
"Three good witches are supposed to give the baby three gifts, you know, like good looks, wisdom and happiness." McGrath pressed on defiantly. "That's how it used to be done in the old days."
"Oh, you mean gingerbread cottages and all that," said Granny dismissively. "Spinning wheels and pumpkins and pricking your fingers on rose thorns and similar. I could never be having with all that."
She polished the ball reflectively. "Yes, but—" McGrath said. Granny glanced up at her. "That was McGrath for you. Head full of pumpkins. Everyone's fairy godmother for two pins. But a good soul underneath. Kind to small furry animals. The sort of person who worried about baby birds falling out of nests."
"Look, if it makes you any happier," she muttered, surprised at herself.
She waved her hands vaguely over the image of the departing carts.
"What's it to be? Wealth? Beauty?"
"Well, money isn't everything, and if he takes after his father he'll be handsome enough," McGrath said, suddenly serious. "Wisdom, do you think?"
"That's something he'll have to learn for himself," said Granny.
"Perfect eyesight? A good singing voice?" From the lawn outside came Nanny Ogg's cracked but enthusiastic voice, telling the night sky that a wizard's staff has a knob on the end.
"Not important," said Granny loudly. "You've got to think headology, see? Not muck about with all this beauty and wealth business. That's not important."
She turned back to the ball and gestured half-heartedly.
"You'd better go and get Nanny, then, seeing as there should be three of us."
Nanny was helped in, eventually, and had to have things explained to her.
"Three gifts, eh?" she said. "Haven't done one of them things since I was a gal. It takes me back. What are you doing?"
McGrath was bustling around the room lighting candles. "Oh, we've got to create the right magical ambience," she explained. Granny shrugged but said nothing, even in the face of the extreme provocation. all witches did their magic their own way, and this was McGrath's house.
"What are we going to give him, then?" said Nanny.
"We're just discussing it," said Granny.
"I know what he'll want,"
said Nanny. She made a suggestion, which was received in frozen silence.
"I don't see what use that would be," said McGrath eventually. "Wouldn't it be rather uncomfortable?"
"He'll thank us when he grows up, you mark my words," said Nanny. "My first husband, he always said..."
"Something a bit less physical is generally the style of things,"
interrupted Granny, glaring at Nanny Ogg.
"There's no need to go and spoil everything, Gaither. Why do you always have to..."
"Well, at least I can say that I..."
Nanny began. Both voices faded to a mutter. There was a long, edgy silence.
"I think," said McGrath, with brittle brightness, "that perhaps it would be a good idea if we all go back to our little cottages and do it our own way. You know, separately. It's been a long day, and we're all rather tired."
"Good idea," said Granny firmly, and stood up. "Come, Nanny Ogg," she snapped. "It's been a long day, and we're all rather tired."
McGrath heard them bickering as they wandered down the path. She sat rather sadly amidst the coloured candles, holding a small bottle of extremely thaumaturgical incense that she had ordered from a magical supplies emporium in faraway Ankh-Morpork. She'd been rather looking forward to trying it. Sometimes, she thought, it would be nice if people could be a bit kinder. She stared at the ball. Well, she could make a start.
"He will make friends easily," she whispered.
Wasn't much, she knew, but it was something she'd never been able to get the hang of. Nanny Ogg, sitting alone in her kitchen with her huge tomcat curled up on her lap, poured herself a nightcap, and through the haze tried to remember the words of verse 17 of the hedgehog song. There was something about goats, she recalled, but the details eluded her. Time abraded memory. She toasted the invisible presence.
"A bloody good memory is what he ought to have," she said. "He'll always remember the words."
And Granny Weatherwax, striding home alone through the midnight forest, wrapped her shawl around her and considered. It had been a long day and a trying one. The theatre had been the worst part. All people pretending to be other people. Things happening that weren't real. Bits of countryside you could put your foot through. Granny liked to know where she stood, and she wasn't certain she stood for that sort of thing. The world seemed to be changing all the time. It didn't used to change so much. It was bewildering. She walked quickly through the darkness with the frank stride of someone who was at least certain that the forest, on this damp and windy night, contained strange and terrible things, and she was it.
"Let him be whoever he thinks he is," she said. "That's all anybody could hope for in this world."
Like most people, witches are unfocused in time. The difference is they dimly realize it and make use of it. They cherish the past because part of them is still living there, and they can see the shadows the future casts before it. Granny could feel the shape of the future, and it had knives in it. It began at 5 the next morning. 4 men rode through the woods near Granny's cottage, tethering the horses out of earshot, and crept very cautiously through the mists. The sergeant in charge was not happy in his work. He was a Ramtops man, and wasn't at all certain about how you went about arresting a witch. He was pretty certain, though, that the witch wouldn't like the idea. He didn't like the idea of a witch not liking the idea. The men were Ramtoppers as well. They were following him very closely, ready to duck behind him at the first sign of anything more unexpected than a tree. Granny's cottage was a fungoid shape in the mist. Her unruly herb garden seemed to move, even in the still air. It contained plants seen nowhere else in the mountains. their roots and seeds traded across 5,000 miles of the Discworld, and the sergeant could swear that one or two blooms turned towards him. He shuddered.
"What now, Sarge?" We spread out," he said. "Yes, we spread out. That's what we do."
They moved carefully through the bracken. The sergeant crouched behind a handy log and said,
"Right, very good. You've got the general idea. Now, let's spread out again. And this time we spread out separately."
The men grumbled a bit, but disappeared into the mist. The sergeant gave them a few minutes to take up positions, then said,
"Right, now we..."
He paused. He wondered whether he dared shout, and decided against it. He stood up. He removed his helmet to show respect, and sidled through the damp grass to the back door. He knocked, very gently. After a wait of several seconds, he clamped his helmet back on his head and said,
"No one in. Blast!"
and started to stride away. The door opened. It opened very slowly, and with the maximum amount of creak. Simple neglect wouldn't have caused that depth of groan. You needed careful work with hot water over a period of weeks. The sergeant stopped, and then turned round very slowly, while contriving to move as few muscles as possible. He had mixed feelings about the fact that there was nothing in the doorway. In his experience, doors didn't just open themselves. He cleared his throat nervously. Granny Weatherwax, right by his ear, said,
"That's a nasty cough you've got there. You did right in coming to me."
The sergeant looked up at her with an expression of mad gratitude. He said,
"Ugh!" "She did what?"
said the Duke. The sergeant stared fixedly at an area a few inches to the right of the Duke's chair.
"She gave me a cup of tea, sir," he said. "And what about your men?" "She gave them one too, sir."
The Duke rose from his chair and put his arm around the sergeant's rustling chainmail shoulders. He was in a bad mood. He had spent half the night washing his hands. He kept thinking that something was whispering in his ear. His breakfast oatmeal had been served up too salty and roasted with an apple in it. And the cook had hysterics in the kitchen. You could tell the Duke was extremely annoyed. He was polite. The Duke was the kind of man who becomes more and more agreeable as his temper drains away, until the point is reached where the words,
"Thank you so much,"
have the cutting edge of a guillotine.
"Sergeant,"
he said, walking the man slowly across the floor.
"Sir?" "I am not sure I made your orders clear, Sergeant,"
said the Duke in snake tones.
"Sir?" "I mean, it is possible I may have confused you. I meant to say, bring me a witch, in chains, if necessary. But perhaps what I really said was, go and have a cup of tea. Was this, in fact, the case?"
The sergeant wrinkled his forehead. Sarcasm had not hitherto entered his life. His experience of people being annoyed with him generally involved shouting and occasional bits of wood.
"No, sir,"
he said.
"I wonder why, then, you did not in fact do this thing that I asked." "Sir?" "I expect she said some magical words, did she? I've heard about witches,"
said the Duke, who had spent the night before reading, until his bandaged hands shook too much, some of the more excitable works on the subject, written by wizards who are celibate and get some pretty funny ideas around 4 o'clock in the morning.
"I imagine she offered you visions of unearthly delight. Did she show you..."
The Duke shuddered.
"Dark fascinations and forbidden raptures, the like of which mortal men should not even think of.
and demonic secrets that took you to the depth of man's desires.
The Duke sat down and fanned himself with his handkerchief.
Are you all right, sir?
Said the sergeant.
What? Oh, perfectly, perfectly.
Only you've gone all red.
Don't change the subject, man,
snapped the Duke, pulling himself together.
Admit it. She offered you hedonistic and licentious pleasures known only to those who dabble in the carnal arts, didn't she?
The sergeant stood to attention and stared straight ahead.
No, sir,
he said, in the manner of one speaking the truth come what may.
She offered me a ban. A ban? Yes, sir, it had currants in it.
Felmet sat absolutely still while he fought for internal peace. Finally, all he could manage was...
And what did your men do about this?
They had a bun too, sir, all except young Roger, who isn't allowed fruit, sir, on account of his trouble.
The Duke sagged back on the window seat and put his hand over his eyes. I was born to rule down on the plains, he thought, where it's all flat, and there isn't all this weather and everything, and there are people who don't appear to be made of dough. He's going to tell me what this Roger had.
He had a biscuit, sir.
The Duke stared out at the trees. He was angry. He was extremely angry. But 20 years of marriage to Lady Filmet had taught him not simply to control his emotions, but to control his instincts as well. And not so much as the twitching of a muscle indicated the workings of his mind. Besides, arising out of the black depths of his head was an emotion that hitherto he had little time for. Curiosity was flashing a fin. The Duke had managed quite well for 50 years without finding a use for curiosity. It was not a trait much encouraged in an aristocrat. He had found certainty was a much better bet. However, it occurred to him that for once, curiosity might have its uses. The sergeant was standing in the middle of the floor with the stolid air of one who is awaiting a word of command, and who is quite prepared so to wait until continental drift budges him from his post. He had been in the undemanding service of the kings of Lancre for many years, and it showed. His body was standing to attention. Despite all his efforts, his stomach stood at ease. The Duke's gaze fell on the fool, who was sitting on his stool by the throne. A hunched figure looked up, embarrassed, and gave his bells a half-hearted shake. The Duke reached a decision. The way to progress, he'd found, was to find weak spots. He tried to shut away the thought that these included such things as king's kidneys at the top of dark stairways, and concentrated on the matter in hand. And he'd scrubbed and scrubbed, but it seemed to have no effect. Eventually he'd gone down to the dungeons and borrowed one of the torturer's wire brushes and scrubbed with that too. That had had no effect either. It made it worse. The harder he scrubbed, the more blood there was. He was afraid he might go mad. He wrestled the thought to the back of his mind. Weak spots, that was it. The fool looked all weak spot.
You may go, sergeant.
So,
said the sergeant, and marched out stiffly.
Fool?
Marry, sir, said the fool nervously. He gave his hated medallion a quick strum. The Duke sat down on the throne.
I am already extremely married, he said. Advise me, my fool.
If faith, nuncle, said the fool.
Nor am I thy nuncle. I feel sure I would have remembered, said Lord Filmet,
leaning down until the prow of his nose was a few inches from the fool's stricken face.
If you preface your next remark with nuncle, faith, or marry, it will go hard with you.
The fool moved his lips silently and then said, How do you feel about prithee? The Duke knew when to allow some slack.
Prithee I can live with, he said. So can you, but no capering.
He grinned encouragingly.
How long have you been a fool, boy?
Prithee, sirrah.
The thirrer, said the Duke, holding up a hand. On the whole, I think not.
Prithee, sirrah, sir, said the fool, and swallowed nervously. All my life, sir, 17 years under the bladder, man and boy, and my father before me, and my nuncle at the same time as him, and my grandad before them, and his...
Your whole family have been fools?
Family tradition, sir, said the fool. Prithee, I mean... The Duke smiled again, and the fool was too worried to notice how many teeth it contained.
You come from these parts, don't you?
Said the Duke. Yes, sir.
So you would know all about the natives' beliefs and so on?
I suppose so, sir. Prithee?
Good. Where do you sleep, my fool?
In the stable, sir.
From now on you may sleep in the corridor outside my room, said the Duke,
beneficently. Gosh!
And now,
said the Duke, his voice dripping across the fool like treacle over a pudding,
tell me about witches.
That night the fool slept on good royal flagstones in the whistling corridor above the great hall instead of the warm, stuffy straw of the stables. This is foolish, he told himself. Marry, but is it foolish enough? He dozed off fitfully, into some sort of dream where a vague figure kept trying to attract his attention, and was only dimly aware of the voices of Lord and Lady Filmot on the other side of the door.
It's suddenly a lot less draughty, said the Duchess grudgingly.
The Duke sat back in the armchair and smiled at his wife.
Well,
she demanded,
where are the witches? The Chamberlain would appear to be right, beloved. The witches seem to have the local people in thrall. The sergeant of the guard came back empty-handed.
Handed. He came down heavily on the importunate thought.
You must have him executed,
she said promptly,
to make an example to the others.
A course of action, my dear, which ultimately results in us ordering the last soldier to cut his own throat as an example to himself. By the way, he added mildly, there would appear to be somewhat fewer servants around the place. You know I would not normally interfere.
Then don't,
she snapped.
Housekeeping is under my control. I cannot abide slackness.
I'm sure you know best, but...
What of these witches? Will you stand idly by and let trouble seed for the future? Will you let these witches defy you? What of the crown?
The Duke shrugged.
No doubt it ended in the river, he said.
And the child? He was given to the witches. Did they do human sacrifice?
It would appear not, said the Duke.
The Duchess looked vaguely disappointed.
These witches, said the Duke, apparently they seem to cast a spell on people.
Well, obviously.
Not like a magic spell. They seem to be respected. They do medicine and so on. It's rather strange. The mountain people seem to be afraid of them and proud of them at the same time. It might be a little difficult to move against them.
I could come to believe, said the Duchess darkly, that they have cast a glamour over you as well.
In fact, the Duke was intrigued. Power was always darkly fascinating, which was why he had married the Duchess in the first place. He stared fixedly at the fire.
In fact,
said the Duchess, who recognized the malign smile,
you like it, don't you? The thought of the danger. I remember when we were married, all that business with the knotted rope.
She snapped her fingers in front of the Duke's glazed eyes. He sat up.
"Not at all," he shouted. "Then what will you do?"
"Wait."
"Wait?"
"Wait and consider. Patience is a virtue." The Duke sat back. The smile he smiled could have spent a million years sitting on a rock. And then, just below one eye, he started to twitch. Blood was oozing between the bandages on his hand. Once again the full moon rode the clouds. Granny Weatherwax milked and fed the goats, banked the fire, put a cloth over the mirror, and pulled her broomstick out from behind the door. She went out, locked the back door behind her, and hung the key on its nail in the privy. This was quite sufficient. Only once in the entire history of witchery in Ramtops had a thief broken into a witch's cottage. The witch concerned visited the most terrible punishment on him. She did nothing, although sometimes when she saw him in the village she'd smile in a faint, puzzled way. After 3 weeks of this, the suspense was too much for him, and he took his own life. In fact, he took it all the way across the continent, where he became a reformed character and never went home again. Granny sat on the broom and muttered a few words, but without much conviction. After a further couple of tries she got off, fiddled with the binding, and had another go. There was a suspicion of glitter from one end of the stick, which quickly died away.
"Drat," she said under her breath.
She looked around carefully in case anyone was watching. In fact, it was only a hunting badger who, hearing the thumping of running feet, poked its head out of the bushes and saw Granny hurtling down the path with a broomstick held stiff-armed beside her. At last the magic caught, and she managed to vault clumsily onto it before it trundled into the night sky as graceful as a duck with one wing missing. From above the trees came a muffled curse against all dwarfish mechanics. Most witches preferred to live in isolated cottages with the traditional curly chimneys and weed-grown thatch. Granny Weatherwax approved of this. It was no good being a witch unless you let people know. Nanny Ogg didn't much care about what people knew, and even less for what they thought, and lived in a new, knick-knack crammed cottage in the middle of Loncra Town itself, and at the heart of her own private empire. Various daughters and daughters-in-law came in to cook and clean on a sort of rota. Every flat surface was stuffed with ornaments brought back by far-travelling members of the family. Sons and grandsons kept the log pile stacked. The roof shingled. The chimney swept. The drinks cabinet was always full. The pouch by her rocking chair always stuffed with tobacco. Above the hearth was a huge pokerwork sign saying, "Mother." No tyrant in the whole history of the world had ever achieved a domination so complete. Nanny Ogg also kept a cat, a huge one-eyed grey tom called Grebo, who divided his time between sleeping, eating, and fathering the most enormous incestuous feline tribe. He opened his eye like a yellow window into hell when he heard Granny's broomstick land awkwardly on the back lawn. With the instinct of his kind, he recognized Granny as an inveterate cat-hater and oozed gently under a chair. McGrath was already seated primly by the fire. It is one of the few unbendable rules of magic that its practitioners cannot change their own appearance for any length of time. Their bodies develop a kind of morphic inertia and gradually return to their original shape. But McGrath tried. Every morning her hair was long, thick, and blonde, but by the evening it had always returned to its normal, worried frizz. To ameliorate the effect, she had to try to plait violets and cowslips in it. The result was not all she had hoped. It gave the impression that a window box had fallen on her head.
"Good evening," said Granny.
"Well met by moonlight," said McGrath politely. "Merry meet. A star shines on—"
"Watch her,"
said Nanny Ogg. McGrath winced. Granny sat down and started removing the hatpins that nailed her tall hat to her bun. Finally, the sight of McGrat dawned on her.
McGrat!
The young witch jumped and clamped her knuckly hands to the virtuous frontage of her gown.
Yes?
She quavered.
What have you got on your lap?
It's my familiar, she said defensively.
What happened to that toad you had?
It wandered off, muttered McGrat. Anyway, it wasn't very good.
Granny sighed. McGrat's desperate search for a reliable familiar had been going on for some time, and despite the love and attention she lavished on them, they all seemed to have some terrible flaw, such as a tendency to bite, get trodden on, or, in extreme cases, metamorphose.
That makes 15 this year, said Granny, not counting the horse. What's this one?
It's a rock, chuckled Nanny Og.
Well, at least it should last, said Granny.
The rock extended a head and gave her a look of mild amusement.
It's a tortoise, said McGrat. I bought it down in Sheepbridge Market. It's incredibly old and knows many secrets, the man said.
I know that man, said Granny. He's the one who sells goldfish that tarnish after a day or two.
Anyway, I shall call him Lightfoot, said McGrat,
her voice warm with defiance. I can if I want.
Yes, yes, all right, I'm sure, said Granny. Anyway, how goes it, sisters? It's 2 months since last we met.
It should be every new moon, said McGrat sternly. Regular.
It was our Graham's youngest wedding, said Nanny Og.
Couldn't miss it. And I was up all night with a sick goat, said Granny Weatherwax promptly.
Yes, well, said McGrat doubtfully. She rummaged in her bag. Anyway, if we're going to start, we'd better light the candles.
The senior witches exchanged a resigned glance.
But we've got this lovely new lamp our Tracy sent me, said Nanny Og innocently. And I was going to poke up the fire a bit.
I have excellent night vision, McGrat, said Nanny sternly. And you've been reading them funny books. Grimmers.
Grimoires.
You ain't going to draw on the floor again, neither, warned Nanny Og. It took our dream days to clear up after those what's-names last time.
Runes, said McGrat. There was a look of pleading in her eyes. Look, just one candle.
All right, said Nanny Og, relenting a bit. If it makes you feel any better, just the one, mind. And a decent white one, nothing fancy.
McGrat sighed. It probably wasn't a good idea to bring out the rest of the contents of her bag.
We ought to get a few more here, she said sadly. It's not right, a coven of 3.
I didn't know we were still a coven. No one told me we were still a coven, sniffed Granny Weatherwax. Anyway, there's no one else this side of the mountain excepting old Gamma Dismas, and she doesn't get out these days.
But a lot of young girls in my village, said McGrat. You know, they could be keen.
That's not how we do it, as well you know, said Granny disapprovingly. People don't go out and find witchcraft. It comes and finds them.
Yes, yes, said McGrat. Sorry.
Right, said Granny, slightly mollified.
She'd never mastered the talent for apologizing, but she appreciated it in other people.
"About this new duke, then,"
said Nanny, to lighten the atmosphere. Granny sat back.
"He had some houses burned down in Badass," she said, "because of taxes."
"How horrible," said McGrat.
"Old King Varence used to do that," said Nanny. "Terrible temper he had."
"He used to let people get out first, though," said Granny.
"Oh, yes,"
said Nanny, who was a staunch royalist. "He could be very gracious like that. He'd pay for them to be rebuilt as often as..."